Support for WGLT comes from Madison House Presents, bringing Bob Dylan and his band live and in concert to ISU's Braden Auditorium October 29th. Tickets available now at Ticketmaster.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A century ago, all sewage and wastewater in Bloomington Normal went into Sugar Creek.
It was very disgusting area. There was a slaughterhouse down in Bloomington that discharged waste from the slaughterhouse, including offal.
Bloomington and Normal Water Reclamation District head Randy Stein tells us about a century of cleaner water. Plus, a fascinating history of why Bloomington Normal still has two separate school districts. And hear a new live album from Saybrook singer-songwriter Chris Corker. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Anyone who's lived in Bloomington Normal has probably wondered the same thing. Why are there two different school districts here, and why is one donut hole inside the other? The answer, of course, is complicated. Today's Unit 5 and District 87 school districts are the product of over 160 years of organic and planned community growth, and voters sealed their separate fates two decades ago in a highly emotional referendum.
I believe this is the only situation in the state where two unit districts are nestled one inside the other.
That's Lynn Hafley, director of Illinois State University's Center for the Study of Education Policy.
And so it's been an interesting, shall we say, outlier for many, many years.
District 87 is the older sibling by quite a bit. It was formed in 1857 and was one of the first school districts in Illinois. It even hired Abraham Lincoln to do some legal work. Unit 5 came along in 1948 as the state moved away from one-room schoolhouses and rural schools and pushed unit districts. Voters created Unit 5 in part because District 87 declined to add all of the schools in the surrounding area, such as Carlock, Hudson, Towanda. That's according to former Unit 5 school board member Doug Reeves.
And they declined because they would have had to provide busing, and they didn't provide busing. So Unit 5 was created basically as the donut around the unit the District 87 hole in the middle.
Alan Lessoff is a history professor at ISU who studied school consolidation here. He says around this time, urban schools like District 87's had more prestige, better funding than the more rural ones like Unit 5. He says the two districts squabbled for years in court about land annexation and the property tax dollars that came with it. By the 1970s, changes to state law had decoupled municipal annexation from the extension of school boundaries. In plain English, that means a city and its local school district were no longer automatically joined at the hip.
Unit 5 was then able to tie up and prevent the continued growth of District 87 just by dragging it out in courts and legal battles and so on.
And this is when the dynamic started to change.
Where Unit 5 replicates kind of suburban-type school districts in, you know, middle-class subdivisions on the periphery of the city, leaving behind the central city schools, which are no longer identified as dynamic, but identified as stagnant and troubled and all the things that people look at. Right in that era when they looked at central cities, inner city schools.
As Bloomington sprawls to the east and the southwest, its school district does not. Fewer Bloomington residents have a stake in District 87, which includes many lower income parts of the city.
In terms of really giving the whole city a stake in how well the city's doing, this separation, right, that of the municipal boundaries from the school boundaries has had just a really enervating effect on politics in the city of Bloomington over a long period of time.
Lessoff says this separation of municipal politics and education politics has become a big, long-term problem.
Because I think it's really important not only to sort of even out development, but to make the different parts of the city feel like they have a common enterprise. Whereas the kind of sociocultural dynamics of the current situation means that outlying subdivisions, they can get most of what they want done, right, without paying too much attention to what's happening in more troubled parts of the area and without really thinking about, well, what really is the economic health of this whole area. Like, you can live in different, basically in different cities.
It wasn't long before a merger of Unit 5 and District 87 was being considered. The Pantograph proposed one in 1964, although neither district supported the idea then. Lessoff says the McLean County Regional Planning Commission studied the issue in 1972, and while they didn't recommend full consolidation, it did suggest a land swap between the districts that would have restored the link between city politics and education politics, but that never happened. Fast forward to 1995. Unit 5's territory had grown to 200 square miles, adding 1,100 students in the past 5 years. District 87 was still landlocked, with 10 miles of tax base, adding only 27 students. Nearly a third of District 87 students were from low-income families, and there were concerns the diversity and socioeconomic gap between the two districts would only grow if left unaddressed. Bill Moeller is a former District 87 school board member.
District 87 had more of the low-income students and the students that needed the most help and needed the special attention and special education and those type of services. So the impetus was District 87's tax base was basically capped, and all this other growth was going on around it for which it was getting no benefit, and that having a single district would help solve that problem.
A committee of 10 successfully placed the merger question on the ballot for voters to decide on March 19, 1996. Preceding the vote, there were months of community forums, events, and pages of letters to the editor in the Pantograph.
So the need, quote unquote, that seemed to permeate the community was that the merger was more or less in lieu of an upcoming and possible crisis or rescue of District 87.
Mueller was a committee of 10 member. He supported the merger, as did most District 87 leaders. More so than the dire predictions about District 87's future, he thought a merged district would simply provide a better education to students, with better programs, more efficiency. There was even talk that consolidation might open the door for career academies focusing on agriculture, industrial technology, or business.
We had silly situations where kids in Unit 5 lived within a few blocks, probably a five-minute walk from a District 87 school, but they were being bused miles to a Unit 5 school, and it made no sense at all.
Unit 5 leaders were opposed to merger. One reason was financial. District 87 teachers generally made more than Unit 5 teachers. That's still true today, by the way. And if the two districts merged, it was likely they'd need to make that higher amount. The state was willing to offset some of that cost, however, by offering a $4,000 per staff member incentive for the first 3 years after any merger. Here's former board president for Unit 5, Doug Reeves.
We could understand mutual benefit. We could understand combined efficiencies. We could understand what cost savings there might be. But we also saw that we were going to be incurring some large costs for those homeowners and property owners in District Unit 5 by having to increase salaries, update some of the Bloomington Unit District 87 schools, since they were mostly older than what ours were. So there were some cost things. We had a lower tax rate than what District 87 had. And all of those things were of concern to us.
Alan Chapman, the future Unit 5 superintendent, was still principal at Normal Community High School back in 1996.
I was convinced at the time that in order to really make a rational decision on potential merger, we really would need to answer two questions. One, can we educate the students of the community better with a merged district? And can we do it more economically? And the information we had at the time did not really answer those two questions, at least to my satisfaction.
Ostensibly, the 1996 referendum was about dollars and cents and educational quality. But there were emotional threads that pulled at voters, perhaps even more strongly than charts and graphs and logical arguments about EAV and per-pupil spending. Doug Reeves says some Unit 5 voters felt slighted that District 87 didn't want them back in 1948 during the big school district reshuffling.
Everything from District 87 didn't want us when I was a schoolboy out in the country to I was burned because I used to live in Unit 5, and then I had to transfer to District 87 because they annexed where I live.
Bill Mueller from District 87 saw that too.
The feeling was that District 87 had rejected them then, and so, no, we don't want to, you know, it's our turn to reject you. And it was ironic to me that, you know, the situation 50 years ago that people were dredging this, you know, dredging up, you know, what they perceived as a slight.
Others saw something darker. Mike Matika thought it had a lot to do with race.
Got a lot of people mad at me when I said that.
Matika is a local union leader, an historian, and former Bloomington City Council member. He's also a local founder of the Not in Our Town group. In 1986, District 87's student body was far more diverse than Unit 5's. Although the pro-merger committee of 10 recommended that no student be required to change schools, there was an undercurrent of concern that Matika traced back to race.
And if you go back and look at the letters to the editor that came with that around that referendum, there were a lot of references to busing. I don't want my kids bused to Bloomington schools.
Let's just say anti-merger voters did not care for that characterization.
A number of people, you know, you should never say that. How dare you say that? I remember one guy telling me, you need to apologize to every small town around here because they're not racist. When you say racism, people take it as an individual thing and not looking at systematic racism. And to me, this was a thing of systematic racism.
Ultimately, voters rejected the merger by a 2-to-1 margin. Even though 69% of District 87 voters supported the idea, 74% of Unit 5 voters did not. It was dead. Today, Illinois has 852 separate school districts, including Unit 5 and District 87. There have not been many mergers in recent years. The last consolidation here in McLean County was El Paso-Gridley in 2004. Lynn Hafley from ISU's Center for the Study of Education Policy says Illinois has lost only 10 districts in the past 7 years. She was a top education aide to former Lieutenant Governor Sheila Simon, and they worked on the Classrooms First Commission together back in 2012 that studied the pros and cons of consolidation. That study found that one big barrier was teacher pay. If the state wanted to merge separate elementary and high school districts into unit districts, that would bring it down to a maximum of about 300 districts. That was going to cost at least $3 billion, primarily because of salary equalization incentives.
It's not as simple as two corporations merging, and now you get rid of half of the administrative staff because you're just running one company instead of two. You're still going to have the same numbers of students to serve. You're still going to need as many teachers as you have now.
And yeah, you might save a superintendent's salary, but larger school districts might require additional assistant superintendents to make things run smoothly.
You know, if bigger was always better, then our biggest school districts would always be financially sound and their kids would be knocking it out of the park. And guess what? We know that's not true.
Illinois school districts, on average, serve around 2,300 students each. That's well below the national average of 3,600 students. Adam Schuster is director of budget and tax research at the conservative think tank Illinois Policy. His group wants to make it easier for voters to initiate consolidation efforts.
That we simply have way too many school districts, and it's costing our state money, and frankly, it's siphoning dollars away from the classroom.
If Unit 5 and District 87 merged tomorrow, the combined district would have nearly 19,000 students. That's pretty big for Illinois. Barry Riley is the superintendent today at District 87, which has around 5,300 students.
When you look around the state at those large unit districts that are over, let's say, 15,000 students, there are not great examples of those that are just doing phenomenal jobs. They're facing challenges, you know, whether you look at Rockford, Elgin, Springfield, Chicago Public Schools, the Peoria, all of these districts face significant challenges.
Let's be clear. There's no current effort underway to try again to merge Unit 5 and District 87. One of the last times it came up was back in 2006 when a report from Unit 5's Citizens Advisory Council said a merger was not needed, but the topic should be periodically evaluated. District 87 School Board President Bridget Beasley says they'd look into it if the community asked, but it's not actively being pursued. Unit 5 School Board President Barry Hitchens says both are in pretty good shape today.
But the current state, both districts are succeeding. If we were in a position where one was succeeding and the other was failing, it'd be a different discussion.
Still, the dynamic today between Unit 5 and District 87 is different than it was back in 1996. Now it's Unit 5 facing serious financial challenges, including a $12 million structural budget deficit. It's prompting speculation that a referendum lay ahead. Back in 1996, the experts said District 87's outlook was bleak without a merger, that it would be able to limp along but would ultimately fail to serve its students adequately. Here's Barry Riley.
But the reality is it didn't come to pass. We went through some challenging times and we had to go through some deficit reduction, but it didn't occur.
And Unit 5 got more diverse, even without absorbing District 87 students. A third of Unit 5 students are now non-whites, and 32% come from low-income families. Mark Jauntry is regional superintendent of schools covering McLean, Logan, Livingston, and DeWitt counties. His father, Gene, was actually regional superintendent back in 1996, when Unit 5 voters rejected the merger.
There's kind of been this thinking out there that maybe, you know, that vote might actually be flipped if you were to hold it today. And I think a lot of that revolves around financial position of the relative to the two districts right now.
23 years later, Bill Mueller, the pro-merger former District 87 board member, says he thinks Bloomington Normal would have a stronger school system had the referendum passed.
I'm not saying that the school districts are bad here now, but they could have been better. And I think that anybody who looks back at the history of this will scratch their head and say, this makes no sense. How did this happen?
You can see documents, studies, and other material from the 1996 referendum at our website, wglt.org. I'm Ryan Denham, and this is Sound Ideas.
Support for WGLT comes from the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Beautiful, the Carole King musical, Sunday, October 20th. All the songs you remember and a story you'll never forget. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and wglt.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Here's something about what might just be Bloomington Normal's most important and least well-known public body. The Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District, or BINWRD, treats all the wastewater from the Twin Cities and some from Downs in the Crestwick subdivision. BINWRD is marking its centennial with an open house from 10 to 2 on Saturday at its headquarters on West Oakland Avenue. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with BINWRD Director Randy Stein, who says before water treatment began about 100 years ago, all sewage from Bloomington and Normal went into Sugar Creek.
Well, it was a very disgusting area. We have some pictures back from the 20s where you can see the results in the creek. There probably wasn't much in the way of fish or macroinvertebrates in that creek. And in starting in about 1914, lawsuits were filed. Complaints were filed, lawsuits were filed with residents in the community and people downstream against the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington for discharging into the creek.
Did all of the household waste go there?
Virtually all of it. And there was a slaughterhouse down in Bloomington that discharged the waste from a slaughterhouse, including offal, O-F-F-A-L.
Guts.
Yes. Went into Sugar Creek directly from the processing plant into Sugar Creek. That area is known as the West Slough. And there were other industrial wastes that were discharged to the creek. Down along Market Street to the south, there was a coal gasification plant that discharged some of their waste products into the creek.
What were those waste products?
Well, they're taking coal, turning into a natural gas product, and some of the residuals contain benzene and tarry-like substance. So the complaints in 1914 through 1916 registered with various agencies in the state of Illinois, and a court order was issued for the communities to come together and form to resolve the issue on discharges into the Sugar Creek. And it wasn't until 1917, after further warnings and threats for public officials to face the music, if you will, on a legal basis, that the district was formed. It was formed by vote in November of 1919. That vote was passed with 2,368 yes votes and 404 no votes.
So pretty pronounced majority in favor.
Right.
So it was clearly a need. Were other municipalities, other cities going through the same process at the time? Was it a movement around
yes.
the nation?
So the district was formed under the Sanitary District Act of 1917. Prior to that time, there were a few other facilities formed. Chicago is the biggest one that was formed in the late 1800s, and they're the folks that reversed the flow of the Chicago River. North Shore Sanitary District was before 1917. But an act was passed in the state legislature called the Sanitary District Act of 1917, and that the Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation, at that time was called the Bloomington Normal Sanitary District, was formed under that act. That is still our guiding charter to date. Other area communities also were formed under the same act. Urbana-Champaign, Decatur, Springfield, all got formed in the early to mid-20s, and various sanitary districts built their facilities in the 20s. Ours was put into operation, the first part of it was put in operation in 1928. That part of the plant is still running since 1928.
That's amazing. The technology is still relevant, the capacity of that original small, obviously it's much bigger now, but it's still done the same way?
There have been many modifications to that original plant process and many additions. We've added a third stage of treatment to the original first two. We have facilities that have been modified and changed. But as of today, that plant still allows us to meet our permit imposed by the Illinois EPA. The future of that plant is going to change because the technology needed to remove nutrients from the wastewater is going to require us to modify that plant.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. I'm talking with Randy Stein, the head of Binward, the Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District. The municipalities and the area it serves have grown tremendously. Would you take us through the evolution of the system and how it's changed since 1919 till now?
Well, in 1928, when the plant first started, we had a process that utilized an MOF tank and a trickling filter. So the goal is to remove BOD, or biological oxygen demand, and to reduce the amount of ammonia discharged to the creek. Since 1928, there have been many modifications, the 40s, the 60s, the 80s, and even as late as 2007. So yes, the community has grown, and therefore the need to add capacity has taken place in the district.
Have the estimates of where the growth is going to happen and how much capacity needed always panned out? I'm looking at the Crestwick plant and how that is arguably, or has been argued in some corners of the community, was overbuilt or wasn't located in the right place as it turned out.
Currently, we have the capacity to treat 30 million gallons a day. And on a daily average, we're about 20 million gallons a day on a daily average, just slightly less than that. The Southeast plant was built, number one, for growth. Growth was projected to the east side of Bloomington. And currently that plant serves everything in Normal and Bloomington, east of Veterans Parkway, and a little bit of the Village of Downs and Crestwick Subdivision. That plant is located on 700 North Road near Randolph, Illinois. It's about 7 miles straight south of Route 9. We have an interceptor sewer that runs down to that plant about 7 miles long. And that plant is only a 7.5 million gallon a day plant. The West facility currently is rated at 22.5. So it did serve an increased growth, which was evident in the early 2000s. But more importantly, it served the community to the east. If we were to serve the growing community to the east at that time with the West plant, we would have had to bring quite a bit of large infrastructure through the town to get to the West plant.
So it remains a valid public policy choice to put it there.
Yes, it does. It allows us some flexibility also for treatment in two places, treating the east side and the west side. We have interconnection and we can transfer flow from east to west and take advantage of some of our wet weather facilities on the west side of town. The West plant serves a large portion of Bloomington that has combined sewers. So not only do we see sanitary sewers, we see quite a bit of stormwater too.
And does that peak volume ever get close to your 30 million gallon capacity?
Our peak capacity for wet weather is over 90, and we have the ability to store on a facility along West Washington Avenue another 80 million gallons to be treated at a later date, like a week or two or days after the storm event.
How have the increase in high precipitation events caused by global climate change with the intense rainfall and very quick accumulation changed the demands placed on the system?
I don't see that. We certainly see more use of that CSO facility on the west side. We've had some years in the recent, that facility was built in 2007. And since 2007, we've had some years where we've hardly used that facility. And then this year, it's been in use frequently this spring.
So it's looking more and more like a good choice because we're getting the increased heavy rainfall events.
Yes, and we are not discharging as much untreated wastewater to Sugar Creek and high flow events. We're able to retain that in that CSO facility.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Randy Stein of the Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District. When people come to your facility on Oakland Avenue, what can they see? What will you be doing?
We're going to have tours of our current treatment facility. We're going to concentrate on the plant we consider plant number 3, activated sludge plant. This is the type of process we're going to be moving forward in the future. We treat wastewater in 3 stages, primary, secondary, and tertiary, and we disinfect with ultraviolet light. Treatment plants used to disinfect with chlorine. That's a World War I weapon of mass destruction. That's gone. An awful lot of people have no clue we're even out there or what we do. So we're going to have tours. Cool. We'll have some equipment around the grounds, mobile equipment, and maybe a big pump or two that are sitting outside. Kind of demonstrates how complex a system like that is. One thing that we do at the district is we have a really robust SCADA system, a computer system that runs the facility. Actually, for operations, we are lights out from about 4:30 in the afternoon to 5 the next morning. And our operators, there's always one on call, can operate the plants, both plants, from their cell phone if necessary. So we have a very robust SCADA system. It's something to see. I mean, there's a lot of plants around the state that are just implementing SCADA systems. We've had it since the 90s. We're pretty proud of that.
In the Southeast plant, you have something that not many plants do.
We have a wetlands facility, and we take a portion of our wastewater. On a dry day, it's probably 50% of our effluent, which goes to Little Kickapoo Creek. We divert that and run it through our wetlands to remove nutrients using natural wetland plants. We've been trying to establish these for about 8 years, and in the summertime, we're getting very good results on nitrate removal.
How big is that wetland area?
About 18 acres. So we have five different cells. In the wintertime, there's a portion of the wetlands that are that has open water because our effluent discharges at 45, and we'll have hundreds of waterfowl that live there during the wintertime. That is a good thing and a bad thing because they usually eat the wetlands plants. So we've isolated some of our cells away from the big pond, and you've used the big pond as a cooling area. All of our nitrogen removing work is done in our follow-on cells.
How many water reclamation districts have wetland areas?
There are very few. I'm only aware of one. I'm certain there's one or two more in the state. We have one of the bigger ones, and ours is dedicated for not only research, but a demonstration plot to show what can be done with a wetlands facility. Our chemist is working on her master's degree in biology, and she's used that wetlands facility in her research.
How much does that slow down the velocity of the release of the treated water then?
We're taking about 1 million gallons, maybe 1.5 million a day through this wetlands facility rather than discharging the creek. I would say it shaves off the peaks and the bumps in nitrogen being released to Sugar Creek. We do a fish survey both on Sugar Creek and Little Kickapoo Creek, and the fish populations in both streams is very robust.
Have they improved or changed since the implementation of the wetland?
It's hard to say if it's wetlands related. The smallmouth bass population has increased in the Little Kickapoo Creek, but I think a lot of that is because downstream, Little Kickapoo Creek flows all year round now. In the past, in the middle of the summertime, we would have pools of water with not much flow, and the pools would tend to have lower dissolved oxygen, and that's not conducive to fish. But now that we have water running through that creek all downstream 24/7, 12 months a year, the dissolved oxygen rates are higher, and got a pretty good smallmouth bass population downstream and other pollution-tolerant fish.
Randy Stein directs the Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
At the Binward Open House, Saturday from 10 to 2, there'll be tours of the current treatment facility and the activated sludge plant. Randy Stein says last year, the Illinois EPA made the Southeast plant the treatment plant of the year. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for WGLT comes from TEDx Normal, an independently organized local TED event enriching the Bloomington Normal community with ideas worth sharing at the Center for Performing Arts on ISU's campus on Saturday, November 16th, 9 to noon. Tickets available at TEDxNormal.net. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. As promoters of Route 66 gather in Normal for a conference, many in the tourism industry are trying to capitalize on nostalgia for the Mother Road. Terry Ryburn restored the old Sprague Super Service along the old highway in Normal and converted it into a gift shop and visitor center. She's also one of the organizers of the Route 66 conference today through Sunday at ISU's Alumni Center. She tells WGLT's Eric Stock the key is keeping Route 66 in the public consciousness. She acknowledges that's become harder to do as the road's heyday fades from memory.
We start to worry that when we're gone, will anyone care about this road? And we're trying to involve young people. How do we get young people interested in the road? And something, a phenomenon that I saw this summer, is that those little kids who enjoyed the movie Cars all those years ago are now old enough to drive, and they're coming in my shop. They're totally excited about traveling the road because of a cartoon that they saw when they were a little kid.
So that movie from, what, almost 15 years ago now sort of stuck with them.
Right.
How do you then capitalize on that? There's been another Cars movie come out since
right.
then. How do you continue to capitalize on that and bring that on to the next generation and so on and so forth?
Well, we just need to get them on the road. That's number one. We get them on the road and they start visiting historic places and they catch the excitement. I've had at least one young man who came, brought his parents who weren't real thrilled about it, but he wanted to do it and so they came along. and they were catching fire. I mean, they were really starting to get excited and to remember things about, you know, their, not their childhood necessarily, but maybe their parents told them something about traveling when Route 66 was in its heyday. So I hear a lot of that in the shop.
Over the last half century, we have moved so much toward interstate travel. Do you feel culturally that that will ever change and go back to the way it had been when Route 66 was in its heyday, or is it simply going to be, it's always going to be a nostalgic piece?
Well, I can't imagine anyone feeling any nostalgia for the interstate. I mean, it's a very convenient and quick way to get from one place to the other. So I think Route 66 will always have a place in popular culture and in nostalgia and just in the memories that people are making as they're traveling. You know, one thing that's different than when I was a kid, of course, is this idea of putting everything on the internet. So people post their trip, and hundreds of people follow that trip. And then I hear people come in, and they keep running into the same people as they travel. Oh, look, they signed the guest book. They must be just ahead of us or whatever. So they're kind of building a community on Route 66. So I think there will always be that strength of memory about the road.
Why do you think people have such a strong sense of connection to Route 66, even if they may not have driven the road back in the day?
Well, for me, it's all about the people. You know, a road is a road. But when they meet people who are living and working along the road and have memories of their own about the road, they sort of take that on, I think. You know, it's there are some really interesting stories about the road, about the people who lived along the road. And one thing I've heard the international folks say, and some of them will do it from Los Angeles to California, it's kind of doing it backwards, in my opinion, but they do. And they will say to me, well, you know, I've been to the U.S. many times. I've been to New York City, Chicago, Disney World, Los Angeles, Las Vegas. Those are the biggies. But they never really think they've seen America until they traveled Route 66. And they stopped and they talked to people and they met people. They met other Americans traveling the road. You know, they met shopkeepers. They met business owners, and they really felt like they got a grasp of what America is and who America is.
Well, it seems as if that was a message conveyed in the Cars movie, where those who travel the highway were part of a connected culture that
right.
you don't get
mm-hmm.
on the interstate system.
Right.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Terry Ryburn, who is one of the organizers for the Route 66 Miles of Possibility Conference coming up in Uptown Normal on October 17th through the 20th. The theme for this year's event is Under the Big Top, linking the Route 66 history with our circus history. And you say that these two parts of our culture are maybe more intertwined than many of us realize.
Exactly. People don't realize that the smaller circuses drove where they needed to be between circuses. So, for instance, I have someone who's speaking at the conference named Sherry Valentine, whose family were the Flying Valentinos. And she has a journal that her mother kept during their travels. And the journal is over Route 66. And her mother kept track of every penny they spent and what they earned and that sort of thing. So many of the smaller circuses would have traveled Route 66 to get from site to site.
And how do you try to tie those two things together in the conference?
Well, one of the purposes of the conference is to talk about Route 66, but also to showcase your community. What is unique about your community? And most people will be aware that we have a very strong circus connection here, particularly with the aerial acts. So we have, and we're involving Gamma Phi Circus. They will be involved in it. And so I think it's a natural fit between Route 66 and the circus.
That was Route 66 conference organizer Terry Ryburn with WGLT's Eric Stock. The keynote speaker for the conference is Candace Taylor. She's been working on a project that tells the story of the Green Book, what's been called the Bible of Black Travel, as it helped people of color travel the country safely. This is Sound Ideas. A Northern Illinois FFA chapter is ranked in the top 10 in the country and headed to their national conference. At home, they're also trying to make people rethink what the organization is and who it's for. IPR's Peter Medlin has more.
It's late afternoon, and the sun is setting over the fields next to Central High School in Burlington. Inside, four students stand at the front of the classroom. Their advisor hits the stopwatch on his phone, and they launch into their presentation.
And today, we're excited to tell you about the story of the
Central Burlington FFA chapter. They've been working on this since before school started.
Each story builds upon one another and began to further define us as a chapter. Oh, that's my ending part.
There are still a few kinks to work out, but in only a few weeks, they'll don their famous blue corduroy jackets and give this presentation on stage in an auditorium at the FFA National Convention.
All in the same room, with one goal. To develop the skills necessary.
They're nominated for the Model of Excellence Award. That means they're in the top 10 of more than 8,000 chapters in the country. Sophomore Sophia Battaglia is one of those students.
It's like mood swings pretty much, where it's like, that's awesome, I'm going to national convention. It's like, oh, I'm going to national convention. Yeah. Like, I don't know my part yet, and we only have this many days.
That's why these students, like junior Eric Metz, are here on a Thursday night.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever studied for something so hard.
Yeah.
I don't study.
The presentation must be 15 minutes, and it covers all of the events and community service the chapter worked on over the past year. And it helps that Central's chapter is growing. So says one of their advisors, Buddy Haas.
So we did have 158 students in the program, and then this year for the 2019-2020, we're right around 220 kids in the chapter. And the program.
And Central is right outside of the Chicago suburbs. But Haas says growth is not just happening in the suburbs and in rural communities.
Seeing the growth of just urban students and urban high schools getting ag programs and FFA is really interesting. And so it's helping kind of shift the dynamic of what ag education and FFA is.
That's important to the students. When asked about misconceptions people have about FFA, the group erupts.
Literally today.
Eric pounds on the table.
Oh, he's missing Halloween for his farmers convention. Yeah. I'm like, all right, FFA is more than just farming. It broadens it goes into everything agriculture related. It's not just farmer convention.
Eric's dad is a farmer, but that's not the case for most people in this chapter or in FFA in general. According to the Illinois State Association FFA, only about 10% of members come from farming families. He even asks one of his fellow FFA officers, Junior Amy Hernandez.
Have you ever been on a farm?
No.
No.
You don't have to.
I've never grown a plant.
Can't keep up a lot.
I've tried and it dies within like 2 weeks. So, I mean, yeah, but that's definitely a big misconception.
Aside from the misconceptions, the students spoke about the opportunities FFA has given them. It's those opportunities that got their advisor, Buddy Haas, into teaching. He actually wasn't a part of FFA in high school because they didn't have a program.
Really, FFA is the reason why I became a high school ag teacher. And the cool part with the regional program we have set up now is that I have the opportunity, hopefully in the future, to even teach kids from my alma mater through District 303 when they start joining our program here in the next couple years.
And Haas understands many students come into ag classes skeptical, and he has to try to win them over. Some of those skeptical students are even officers now. That includes Ashley Walker.
I tried to get out of intro to ag and go into another science class, and I couldn't change it, and it was God's plan.
It helps that a lot of social issues and careers dovetail into agriculture. Major laws like hemp production to global issues like climate change all have roots in ag.
I tell the students a lot, by 2050, you know, the world's demand for food is going to double, and we got to figure out how we can feed that world. And so having an ag class, you know, I tell them, I say it's not just about farming, it's about if you like wearing clothes, if you like eating, like going places, that's ag.
The group is going to the national convention at the end of October. The chapter has never been in the top 10 before, and by the time they leave, they could be number one in the nation. I'm Peter Medlin.
And now to the world of music. Alcohol and Anger fuel many of the original songs on the just-released Gill Street Sessions live album from Saybrook singer-songwriter Chris Corkery. He stopped by the WGLT studios to talk with John Norton about this debut album on Central Illinois-based Otoraki Records.
Sometimes I drink and I smoke a little more than I should. Sometimes I stay up too late when I'm up to no good.
Listening to it front to back, my first reaction was, boy, there's a lot of alcohol and anger on this album. Even though it's a live album, that did you have your set list ahead of time, or yeah, were you winging it while you were out there?
I did have a set list going on. For the alcohol and anger part, that a lot of these, some of these songs have come when I did the Honky Tonk Tour circuit, which is kind of like the hard country, outlaw country kind of stuff. So I wrote this batch of songs that were kind of centered around that kind of dynamic with the hard drinking outlaw troubadour kind of thing, and the honky tonks and bar, you know, heavier, hard scrabble living kind of thing.
Well, I drank beer in Oklahoma, wine in Kansas City. They kicked out every bar in old St. Louis. Slowed the whiskey in Kentucky, down gin down in Baton Rouge. But I just can't drink my mind off of losing you.
At that time, I was listening to a lot of George Jones and Johnny Paycheck.
Back when you were doing that honky tonk tour?
Yeah, a lot of those, and those songs, you know, you got to do those. Doing that tour was pretty hard. It was a grind, and you got to be able to play, you know, the real kind of salt of the earth country stuff.
What is it about the honky tonk songs, the songs about pain and drinking and things like that? What is it about that really?
The gritty reality of it. You know, with country music is, in my opinion, there's nothing really too arty about it. I mean, I like a lot of artistry and songs, you know, about kind of fictitious or stories about things like that, and, you know, kind of conceptual. But this, with country music, this the raw, visceral, gritty reality of it really struck me. And there's these songs about hard scrabble people living hard lives, you know, there's something about people trying to channel that into, and unfortunately, sometimes vices, you know, some of these songs are pretty heavy with that, you know, the drinking and stuff like that. But it's kind of like almost like a warning, you know, this is not necessarily, I'm not necessarily promoting it, but saying it's kind of like, whoa, you know.
Well, it sounds like you really want to go beneath the surface.
Yeah. Deeper than just, hey, this is, I'm just going to go and kind of drink my mind away off whatever problem you have. Like say, well, okay, well, this is what's going to happen if you end up doing that. This is what you're going to look like. You know, it's just, yeah, like never drinking again, stuff like that. And just can't drink my mind off losing you. You know, all those songs kind of show that, okay, well, if you do this, then you could be headed down a path. It's also kind of showing that, you know, so in reality, unfortunately, sometimes people do, especially with, you know, with country and stuff, that's how a lot of people just go and kind of go hit the bottle and try to forget about their woman or whatever.
Used me and left me. She sure did. But thank God I'm alone. Cause every day is just like Christmas. Now that you're gone, you're a cold.
Chris Corkery, our guest on WGLT Sound Ideas. The new album is The Gill Street Session. We were talking off the air. I mentioned how I love to travel the back roads of McLean County. Yeah. I've had done that for decades.
Yeah.
It's relaxing to me. I'll turn the radio up and just literally go on dirt roads and cornfields. You can't see anything.
Right.
And you said that's kind of what you like to do.
Yeah, especially when I first, a lot of these songs too, that, you know, we're talking about the honky tonk ones, those were written on the road in McLean County too, some of the country gigs. But there's something about being able to drive towards the horizon. And especially, I mean, now it's a beautiful time of year, too, with fall, but springtime.
Yeah. Do you prefer when the corn is high or when it's low?
Oh, man. I like that. There's something about the corn being high and this that I do love. You know, that when it's so, but it's just full-on summer and the corn is green and the blue of the sky is almost like a razor-sharp blue and, you know, not a cloud in the sky. And the sun's kind of like hazy, maybe going down a little bit and such. I like the green of the corn.
You know, we've been weaving songs of anger and alcohol in and out of our conversation here.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned, there are some songs
that have
focus
nothing.
And Anything For You is one that really jumped out at me. This is a sweet song.
Thank you so much. I wrote that actually for my girlfriend, Carrie. I wrote it in our kitchen or her house. It was before I was staying with her. Before she was getting up, and I was up and letting the dogs out and such, and I just kind of came up with this idea, because she always wants coffee before she goes to work.
I went uptown as you were sleeping. Get your coffee for the day. And I know work will be a long one.
Because she works post office, and I think it was during peak time, too, so she was going to be working like, you know, something like 12, 13 days in a row or such. So I go up and go to Casey's and get her coffee. And say that, you know, tell her that work's going to be okay and such, and try to give her a little pep talk in the morning. And just I was appreciating so much of what she does for me as far as support is not only me as a person, but musically.
Yeah.
I mean, she does so much for me that she's kind of helps me manage, helps me, you know, she runs some of the social media stuff. But, you know, I run songs by her all the time. And what was funny was just when I first figured it out, I couldn't really get a grasp on it. And she's like, oh, you know, that's cool, you know, whatever. But then I kind of made me like, man, I really wanted this to be a splash, you know. So I went back and kind of rehoned it and then, you know, played it for her. And she's like, wow, you know. So it was one of those where the idea kind of first, like, she kind of was like, oh, you know, this is good, but not, maybe it needs something. And then she's really constructive criticism that paid off. And so I went back and reworked the chords and the chorus and stuff. And it turned out into this really sweet love song. That's one of my favorite ones off the album. So I really
I just want to see you smile. Cause you know I do. Anything for you. Yeah.
Anything for you is the song. Chris
Anything
Cordray
for you, yeah.
On WGLT Sound Ideas from the new Gil Street Sessions album. Final question.
Yeah.
What's your proudest moment about this record?
Gosh, good question. I love Anything for You because that is probably the most pure sentiment. You know, it was one of the newer songs at that time. And that was kind of showing my addition to of playing, kind of getting back to the songwriter thing as well as the honky-tonk thing, this kind of collab, this kind of, you know, mix of both these styles that I've kind of had my whole career. But also, I mean, as far as covers, Slide Away and Wild Horses, those are two ones that were really when I kind of was playing. This seemed like the outside area seemed like everything just stopped, and it was just me and the song. I was able to just dig in and just kind of throw everything into it, and it was like nothing else in the world was going on. You know, close your eyes and sing.
And wild horses will ride them someday.
But I'd say just being able to play Anything for You and really kind of have that sentiment, pound for pound, I love doing that song. And every time it comes up on the list, I love playing it every time. I've done it some like 200 times, you know, since then. So,
well, congratulations on the album. This is fantastic.
Thanks, thank you, man.
Anything for you.
Singer-songwriter Chris Corkery speaking with WGLT's John Norton about his new album, The Gil Street Sessions. Corkery's album release party and performance is Saturday, beginning at 7 o'clock at Keg Grove Brewing Company in Bloomington. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the WGLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlenker, Eric Stock, and John Norton. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One.
I'm a baby blue.
This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Thank you.